Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful for him to eat, nor those who are with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here." Well, those are the words of Jesus of Nazareth, "Something greater than the temple is here." And they're the words that we begin this week's podcast. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Solomon's Porch. We are, believe it or not, up to episode 11. This is the podcast, for the week of December 3rd. Remember, we're always about a week ahead, so you may be catching this a little bit earlier of that, and that's great. This way you can stay ahead of the game. Going to take a sip of my Earl Grey. I don't know what your favorite beverage is, but I like a good cup of Earl Grey now and then, especially in this nice, cool fall weather. How you doing? You have a good Thanksgiving? I hope so. I hope you're ready for another week of diving into biblical theology, and we have a doozy for you today. We're going to look at chapter 7 of the book, The House of the Lord, and the chapter's called Jesus, God's Eternal High Priest. And this chapter has the distinction of bringing to a close really four consecutive chapters that have focused on just the whole notion of priesthood as it relates to temple theology. And that means that next time in chapter 8, we'll be moving into sort of a new dimension, getting back into temple structures and other particularities. And that's going to take us into chapter 8, which is on the tabernacle. So that'll be exciting. Now, I want to give you a little heads up where we're at in the Solomon's podcast universe in terms of what's ahead and how this coordinates to the book. So as I said, this coordinates to December 3rd, and that's because the week of December 3rd. And that's because we have published a calendar that coincides with the fall of 2017 and the book discussion club that's going on. You're like, well, wait a minute. I didn't know there was a book discussion going on. I just thought there was like a book and you're kind of talking about the book. Well, that's true. And you can use the podcast in that way. You're free to just check it out and enjoy it, chew on it. But we have a number of people that are actually reading the book sort of together, The House of the Lord, and talking about it online. And the place for that, where that happens, is called the Outer Court, is in the Outer Court of the Temple. And you can find us and join us there by going to facebook.com/theoutercourt. And you'll find a lot of other like-minded people, both from Catholic and non-Catholic backgrounds, young and old, that are just very committed to journeying together into this whole topic we call temple theology and frankly just scripture, and using the book The House of the Lord, which came out this August, which yours truly is the author of, to do so. And we have just a couple episodes left after this one before we come to the Christmas break. So I want to tell you about that. The next episode will be dealing with... So we just have a couple of episodes to go after this one before we take a Christmas break. The week of December 10th, which is next time, we'll look at chapter 8, which is on the tabernacle. We're going to break that into two pieces, and you'll see on the schedule. This is published, by the way, at the facebook.com/theoutercourt page I mentioned, called The Outer Court. And you can find it by going to the facebook.com/theoutercourt page itself, or even better, join the Outer Court book discussion group. It's a group listed on that page. Membership is free. There's no obligation, but it just kind of takes you further up and further into the discussion. There's a file on there which actually has the schedule. Okay, but anyways, that'll be next time, chapter 8, and then that's the week of December 10th, and the week of December 17th is the last one of the year, in a sense, and that's where we will finish up chapter 8, and also I'll kind of do a retrospect and look back at where we're at this point in the book. Okay, so that's coming up as well in just a few weeks, and again, you can find this published calendar at The Outer Court. So, and then what'll happen is we'll take a Christmas break. I'll tell you more what's going to happen during the break, because there will be some cool things going on when I'm in Israel. And so make sure to listen to the next couple episodes where I talk more about what's ahead. Before now, we have our work cut out for us, because we have a very thick and very significant chapter here. I'm talking about the chapter on Jesus's eternal high priesthood. This brings to closure four chapters in the book, which are devoted to talking about this institution of the priesthood and how it all points forward to Jesus Christ, our eternal high priest. Just a spot more of eternally flavorful Earl Grey on my part. Listen to this. This is from Hebrews. If you don't have the book, just open your Bible to the book of Hebrews. And if you do have the book, hey, open it anyways. But this is found on page 121 of the House of the Lord. Hebrews 2, verse 18. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make expiation for the sins of the chapter. I go on to say that how, you know, the previous chapters in the book focused on the priesthood of the Old Testament, but this chapter focuses on the high priesthood of Jesus Christ. And in a particular way, I draw upon a fellow Catholic biblical scholar for some fresh insights on Jesus the high priest, and that is Dr. Brant Petrie. If you're not familiar with Brant Petrie, well, you should be. Many of you will be. He's written a number of good books, and he's a very popular speaker at conferences around the country. And you can find some of his audio teaching CDs at the same group of people who represent me. They represent Brant as well, and that's CatholicProductions.com. You can also find him in a number of published essays in a wonderful Catholic journal that comes out annually, and that journal is called Letter and Spirit. It's published by the Emmaus Academic Press in Steubenville, Ohio. Dr. Scott Hahn is the editor-in-chief. And in Chapter 7 of The House of the Lord, I interact quite a bit with Brant Petrie's article called Jesus, the New Temple and the New Priesthood. And so what you're going to find in many ways is me sort of interacting with Dr. Petrie's essay and drawing on it throughout. So if you have access to that Letter and Spirit Journal article, you at some point may want to read it, because I think it'll be, number one, great additional reading, and also give you a better flavor for what I'm talking about here in the book. But it's not altogether required. If you don't have it, don't worry about it. Okay. So what this chapter really does is it brings us into the New Testament. And we are now at a vantage point where we can look back, right? Sort of like on a plateau, we've climbed up a big bluff or cliff, and we can look back down and see where we've come from. We're at a vantage point where we can see these developments of priesthood. Let's just review a little bit. The first thing we talked about in the house of the Lord as it pertains to priesthood is just how it's gotten short shrift in the 20th century from many who basically knew better, who knew otherwise but didn't give us the full story. I'm talking about certain biblical critics and biblical scholars that in many ways kind of overlooked priesthood, or at least put it in kind of a shoddy light. And we explored some of the reasons why that is. I don't want to rehearse them here, but there's a kind of a bias, right? Or there was a particular bias. It began really in the, many ways, in the 19th century, and it really reached its high point or low point, depending on how you want to talk about it, in the 20th century, especially in the first half. But we're still dealing with the aftermath of it. And that aftermath isn't pretty, because it means we have really generations of people who were taught some of this stuff and really don't have an understanding of just how significant temple theology is and just how crucial priesthood is to the Old and to the New Testament, to Jesus' own identity. In addition to that, we talked about some of those dimensions that are most crucial to the house of the Lord. That is how Adam is the primordial, the first high priest, right? He's a son of God, but he's also a priestly figure. It means he's meant to be fruitful and multiply, to radiate temple holiness in the Garden of Eden, in the holy place, and to make sure, first and foremost, that the temple remains holy. Of course, he violates that duty through his and through Eve's sin. And we have sort of here, to tie in an idea from last week, the kind of first golden calf incident, right? In terms of the man and the woman eating from the tree of that which they were called not to eat, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and they are cast out. So the high priest becomes the one who is cast out, not the high priest who casts out something that kind of gets into the temple that shouldn't be there, but he himself is the object, the thing cast out. We talked about this end of Genesis 3. You are Adam from Adamah, right? You are the man from the ground. And so the man taken from the ground is in some sense has forced to return to the ground by the sweat of his brow, and the woman has other sort of curses or punishments that are really self-induced. They're both self-induced, which includes increased pain in childbirth and a desire for her husband, but her husband ruling over her. So we get kind of the battle of the sexes, so to speak. But we also have this kind of priesthood that continues, but it's sort of in a fugitive sense. Adam's on the run. Remember Harrison Ford in The Fugitive? It's kind of Adam and Eve, right? They're sort of running for their lives. And what that means is that while there's still goodness in them, they produce children. And some of these children really honor God very faithfully, like Abel and Noah and Noah's son Shem and Abraham and many others. But there also is another dimension of humanity that defies God and kind of becomes the delinquent high priest and delinquent people. We're talking about Cain, who slays his brother, and Noah's son Shem, who rapes Noah's wife and Shem's mother, and sets up a whole line of faithless nations opposed to God. I'm talking about the Canaanites, and on and on, right? So these are the sort of the two lines of humanity that sort of emerge, one that are really faithful priests and faithful sons and daughters and unfaithful priests. Then we looked at how this priestly line this kind of priestly dimension of the Old Testament really is in many ways sort of highlighted by this really strange figure whose name is Melchizedek, right? Who is, if you know a little Hebrew, Melchizedek means righteous king or king of righteousness. And this is in Genesis chapter 14, and it's this Melchizedek figure who's king of Salem, that is to say an earlier sort of version of Jerusalem, who offers bread and wine to El Elyon, to the God of the mountain, to Abraham's God. And just as soon as he comes into the picture, he disappears. But we talked about his kind of mysterious identities. He's kind of emblematic, archetypal of this early priesthood prior to the Levites. And that priestly dimension really belongs to all fathers and sons, to the firstborn, until such time as it's taken away. And that's what we talked about last episode, episode 10, that the priestly dimension of Israel's calling to God, or I should say Israel's calling has a priestly dimension from the very beginning. And as I stressed, it does not end even when Adam is kicked out of the garden. It's not like he loses his priestly privileges. He just loses his place in the temple of God. So his sons exemplify a priestly dimension, right? Cain and Abel, as do Noah. Noah builds an altar, as does Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Continues on in Israel, even up to the time of Moses, until the golden calf that's in it, which we talked about last time. The golden calf apostasy brings about this profound change in the priesthood, where the priesthood of Israel is taken away from them. Again, Numbers chapter 3, verse 11 and following, and is delivered strictly to the Levites, who the scriptures say ordain themselves. And we talked about why and how, what that means, that their ordination is sort of self-evident by means of their justice before God and before defending God in God's name. And they then exemplify their holiness and are chosen by God to carry on this kind of pruning of the priesthood from all of Israel to just one of the 12 tribes, the Levites, with Aaron as the first high priest, and then subsequent generations leading all the way down to, frankly, the destruction of the temple in Jesus's, just after Jesus's day, right, in 70 AD. So it lasts for all that time, and it serves a very great purpose in terms of the Levitical priesthood does, in terms of offering the people God's mediators, God's holy mediators, who will offer up themselves, even as they offer sacrifices to God on behalf of themselves and on behalf of all the people and their sins. So they are play a crucial role throughout the period of the Old Testament. But now we really bring our priestly story to a close by talking about how all of that, right, how all of that from Adam all the way up through the last of the Levites, right, how all of that is simply just a foreshadowing of the true high priesthood that is yet to come. And again, we can look at the book of Hebrews. This is what introduces the chapter, right? Where it says, "Therefore, therefore Jesus had to be made like his brothers in every respect," right? Meaning that Jesus is fully God, fully man, right? One person, two natures. And so in his full human nature, he's like us in every way except sin, right? There's his divine nature. "So that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make expiation for the sins of the people." Now, what's interesting about, you know, looking at that passage is it leaps right over the Gospels, right? So we go from the priesthood of Adam and Israel and Melchizedek, and then finally the Levites and all the old covenant priesthood, to this quote talking about Jesus' high priest, right? And I did that intentionally to kind of show where the story goes. But what we have to do now in this episode is talk about how it is that Jesus himself could be seen as a priest when, first of all, he's not a Levite, and second of all, how he's the eternal high priest, how he's the unique divine high priest, and how everything in Jesus's priesthood, everything in Jesus's life, is kind of drawing together all the strands of the Old Testament priesthood into himself and then transfiguring those, so that what he offers us is a kind of perpetual sacrifice through his love, through his death on the cross, through his resurrection, and the Eucharist. If you have this chapter, you know it's highly Eucharistic. So let's get into it. So for starters, on page 123, I drew on the chapter in Matthew's Gospel, Matthew 12, which I read at the opener of the episode, where Jesus says something greater than the temple is here. We're going to come back to this. This is one of the major clues that Jesus is not just a prophet, not just a rabbi, but indeed is the embodiment of God's temple on earth, the temple in person, right? Think about it. Jesus says something greater than the temple is here. Well, first of all, what's greater than the temple? Think about it. Just think for a minute. What could possibly be greater than the temple? Nothing except God himself, right? Because God's very presence dwells in the Holy of Holies. And even if one isn't the high priest in the Holy of Holies, every time one goes near the temple, even near its outer gates or comes into the temple, one is coming into this encounter with God in some sense, right? But Jesus, in saying something greater than the temple is here, is making a divine claim in Matthew 12. You see that, right? Because in saying something greater than the temple is here as a self-reference, what he's saying is something greater than the temple, that is God himself, is with you. And that is important to understand, is that from the very announcement of Jesus, right? From the very announcement of the virgin birth in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke, we are already clued into the mystery that the evangelists are going to write about, and that is that the time has come. What Paul calls the fullness of time has been fulfilled, Galatians 4:4. The time of the old covenant is ending, and the time of the new covenant has arrived in person, in the flesh. Something greater than the Jerusalem temple is here. The next sort of set of evidence or data that I bring forth that builds the argument for Jesus the high priest, Jesus the true priest, is from something he says in John's gospel. Let's open up to John chapter 1. John chapter 1, while you're turning there, I'm going to have another sip of tea. And in John chapter 1, Jesus says, speaking to his new disciples and to Nathanael in particular, "Truly, truly, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Now, this is where Jesus has seen, right, Nathanael under the fig tree and says, "Do you believe because of that? You shall see greater things than these." And then he offers that saying. So what I draw upon here, and I bring in Dr. Petrie's article as well, but also a number of scriptures. Let me give you the two scriptures that are in play from Jesus' saying. The first is, and really most obvious one, is in Genesis chapter 28. Genesis 28, chapter 28 of Genesis, verse 10 to 17, is the story of Jacob, who has this image of a ladder or a staircase that leads to heaven. And he sees angels of God ascending and descending upon that. So Jesus is putting in the place of that heavenly image of really the staircase between earth and heaven, right? Where Jacob sees angels walking upon this staircase that leads to the heavenly temple. The Son of Man. In other words, the angels are not ascending and descending upon this staircase between heaven and earth, but upon the Son of Man. Which is to say that the Son of Man is this mediator, is himself this sacrificial agent, this ladder that one climbs from earth to the heavenly temple. The other scripture that is drawn upon here is Daniel chapter 7. And this is a very, very important passage as well, because it's in Daniel chapter 7 where we're introduced to this mysterious Son of Man figure. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, Daniel says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom shall not be destroyed." And so taken together, this image of the Son of Man from Daniel, which has its own sort of temple ramifications to it, right? And Genesis chapter 28, where Jacob has this vision, together talk about the glory of God, the temple of God, and this heavenly man, the Son of Man, who is the one who will bring forward this kingdom and this heavenly temple to earth. And so I say, regarding this first aspect, quote, in ancient Judaism, that the temple was the dwelling place of God. Jesus, by contrast, transfers this belief to himself, thereby indicating or thereby identifying himself as the true temple of God. I'm quoting here Dr. Petrie from that article I mentioned. Let me finish the quote here. He is not only greater than the present temple, the dwelling place of God on earth, but at the revelation of the Son of Man, he will be shown to be the heavenly temple of God, the dwelling place of the Lord that was revealed to the patriarch Jacob. So what Petrie's getting at here is that Jesus' own statement can only be understood as a self-revelation and profession that he himself is the new temple. There can be no doubt about that. Petrie puts it this way, and I italicize this. It's such a great sentence. The old Jerusalem temple must make way for the unveiled glory of the divine presence that will be manifest in the coming heavenly Son of Man. And that's indeed who Jesus is, right? The heavenly Son of Man that he himself talks about. Let me read that again. It's just such a great line. The old Jerusalem temple must make way, and it does make way, right? For the unveiled glory of the divine presence that will be manifest in the coming heavenly Son of Man. Now, that unveiled glory that Petrie's talking about is something that's revealed ultimately only in the resurrection, right? Because prior to that, Jesus's glory is veiled, right? All throughout John's gospel, we're told that prior to his arrest and trial and crucifixion, we're told his hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come, over and over, right? Woman, what have you to do with me? My hour has not yet come. So there's a sense in which there's a veiling of this heavenly glory. It's pulled back on a couple of occasions prior to the cross. I feel like I'm in the classroom. Does anybody know? Is what I want to say. Raise a hand. All right. Well, let me give you the two. The first would be at his baptism, right? Let's take a look at the baptism scene in Matthew's gospel. So in Matthew chapter 3, verse 16, we read, and when Jesus was baptized, he went up immediately from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened. I was sure remind us of those texts from Genesis 28 and Daniel 7 that we looked at, right? The heavens were opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him, and lo, a voice from heaven saying, this is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. So that's the first example, right, which is the baptism. The second example is found in the Transfiguration, which we're going to talk about these scenes later in the book when we get to temple theology in the New Testament. But for now, let's just preview it by looking at, let's look at Luke's version. So Luke chapter 9, Luke 9, verse 28. And about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James and went up the mountain to pray. And when he was praying, this is, of course, the tradition for this happens on Mount Tabor, which is roughly in Galilee. It's a little bit further to the between the Sea of Galilee itself on one hand and the Mediterranean Sea, sort of like midway between there. But that's the tradition where this happens on high in Mount Tabor. And we read, while he was praying, the appearance of his countenance was altered, and his raiment became dazzling white. And behold, two men talked with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure when he was to accomplish, which he was to accomplish at Jerusalem. And again, we hear the same echo at the end of the text in Luke chapter 9, verse 35, near the end there, where it says, and a voice came out of heaven saying, this is my Son, my chosen, listen to him. So it's really like an echo of what happens in the baptism. And this is one of three scenes in the Gospels in which we hear God the Father speak. The first is in the baptism of Jesus. The second one, as we just saw, is in the Transfiguration. And the third one, which is maybe most interesting in the sense that it's not connected to one of these great epiphanies like the baptism or the Transfiguration, but it happens right before Jesus goes into the upper room with his apostles. And that's in John chapter 12. And it's only in John chapter 12 where the Greeks come to see Jesus, right? And it's there that God the Father once again speaks. So all three of these occasions point us to this reality that there is a deepening of revelation that's happening in the ministry of Jesus Christ that is beginning to unveil in its totality, but only something that's fully revealed on the cross and in the resurrection, that Jesus is the new temple. Another piece of data that I talk about in this chapter of the priesthood of Jesus is in regard to the what's called the, well, I don't really like what it's called, but I'll tell you what it's called, and then I'm going to give you a new sort of phrase for it. I'm talking about the cleansing of the temple, which is found, for example, in Mark chapter 11 and in the other Gospels. You can see, for example, in Matthew 21 and Luke 19. In the Synoptics, it happens at the end of Jesus' ministry. In John's version, it happens at the very beginning in John 2, verse 13. So whether it's in the beginning of Jesus' ministry in John or at the end, that is to say in the in Holy Week, at the very end of his ministry, but in all four Gospels, we have this cleansing of the temple. I don't really like the term cleansing of the temple because I think it mischaracterizes what's really going on there theologically. And we'll talk about this later in the book. We're going to look at, in some depth, the cleansing of the temple. And I really rename it Jesus's temple action. I don't know that it's wrong to think of the scene as the cleansing of the temple, but I think it's a better way to put it, is Jesus's temple action. I have to give credit where credit's due. It's biblical scholar Nicholas Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N, and his book Jesus the Temple, that really really impressed me with not only the naming of the scene in a much more apt way, but Perrin's interpretation is much to commend to it, and we'll talk about that a bit later. But for now, I just want to mention that, here's what I say. Clearly, this is a symbolic action of Jesus. I'm picking it up on page 126 of the book. But what does it mean? Often scholars speak of the righteous indignation of Jesus the prophet. You can find that in a whole number of scholars. You find it in Raymond Brown, in a number of other people. It's very, very common to read it in that way. And I think that's, a misfortune. So I say, is there more than this? Most certainly. Jacob Neusner astutely explains that Jesus' actions would have provoked astonishment. Right? And the reason this is so, I say, is that the overturning of the money changers' tables represents an act of rejection of the most important rite of the Israelite cult, the burnt offering or the whole offering. And therefore, a statement of some sort or another, right, that there is a means of atonement other than the daily whole offering, which is known in Hebrew as tamid. And what I really aim towards here in a spiritual sense is that replacement, that offering that is yet to come, that is going to sort of take up and not abolish, but take up the earlier offering into its mystery, into its meaning, that is yet to come, is this offering of the new covenant, and that is, of course, the Eucharist. And so I say, then what was to take place of the daily offering? It was to be the rite of the Eucharist, table for table, whole offering for whole offering. And there I'm quoting Jacob Neusner, which is interesting to bring Neusner into this, because if you're not familiar with Neusner, he is a very, really famous Jewish theologian and Jewish rabbi. In fact, so much so that Pope Benedict really interacted with Jacob Neusner in his Jesus of Nazareth book, in the second volume, where he really deals with the Last Supper and looks at Neusner's explanation. And a number of times he's quoted Neusner as just being a very, you know, kind of like a high-level interlocutor or sort of dialogue partner, if you want to put it that way. But what's interesting about Neusner is while he himself is a Jewish rabbinical scholar and not a Christian theologian, it's Neusner who says, yeah, this is Eucharist. This is only understood in the context of what the scriptures describe as the institution of the Eucharist in the upper room. So I find that to be particularly fascinating, that someone who doesn't have a horse in the race, you know, in terms of Catholicism, he's not a Catholic, is yet able to identify that what's really being prefigured here is the institution of the new covenantal sacrifice that we call the Holy Eucharist. This leads to a discussion deep in this chapter, then, of the Eucharist itself. So now that we've brought it up, we move into that. And so I talk about the institution scene in Matthew. And I bring in yet another very renowned biblical scholar who's a German, who's a Lutheran scholar, whose name is Joachim Jeremias. Joachim Jeremias. And he, too, seems to understand the deeper significance of this temple language that Jesus is using in describing himself. Here's what Jeremias says. And this is on 127. Joachim Jeremias pointed out that by utilizing the combined imagery of body and blood, any ancient Jew, all right, would have recognized that Jesus is applying to himself terms from the language of sacrifice, that is to say, temple sacrifice. This is especially true of the image of blood being poured out. Such language is clearly sacrificial imagery drawn directly from the liturgy of the temple. And there I cite a couple of scriptures from the Old Testament in which you can see those. I'll give them to you here in case you don't have the book, and that's Leviticus chapter 4, verses 5 and 7, Leviticus 4, verse 5 and 7, as well as Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 26 and 27. And Dr. Petrie echoes what Jeremias clearly observes, and he says, the temple has now been replaced by the immolated body of Jesus. The temple has been replaced. The very body and blood of the crucified Messiah is now revealed as the true temple of God. Now, there's more scriptures than I can possibly deal with in this episode, but I want to skip over a couple, and I want to get to the one that I started the podcast with today, and that is from Matthew chapter 12. It's where Jesus is involved in a so-called Sabbath controversy. And let me read it for us again. It's in the chapter. You'll find it on page 123, or you can just open up your Bible to Matthew chapter 12. And this is what we read. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry. They began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. Now remember, it's the Sabbath. And this is restricted because it constitutes, in a strict interpretation at least, work. Like the kind of work that would be done in collecting grain that farmers and others would be involved with. So there's a sense in which they're, at least technically speaking, seem to be in violation of the rules of the Sabbath. And the Pharisees are waiting to spring on Jesus, right, because of this. And so they pointed out to him, like, in case you didn't notice what's going on here, look what they're doing, right? But it's Jesus's statement that is so mysterious. Now listen to what he says. This is again in Matthew 12. Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? Notice that those who were with him, those are the ones who were in the place of those who are with him are really being represented by the disciples. Therefore, Jesus is being juxtaposed. David, that's key, right? Those who were with him, okay, and how he, David, entered the house of the Lord, or house of God, and ate the bread of the presence. That's the priestly bread that was stored in the holy place, which is only open to priests. So they're eating priestly bread, which is itself a mystery, right? Because David is not a priest, nor the men who are with him, right? Who are assumingly his men, his closest followers. So, or is he a priest, right? Well, it turns out that the book of Hebrews will tell us that David was a priest after the order of Melchizedek, right? Psalm 110, the Lord said to my Lord, you are a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Pardon me. And so there's a sense in which David is a kind of recapitulation of Melchizedek. He is a priest of this different origin, the priest of this earlier type, not rooted in the Levitical ancestry and Levitical order, but in this kind of earlier natural priesthood that was given by God to all of Israel, actually beginning with Adam. So it's kind of this prior to the Mosaic covenant, you might say. And so it's in that context of David and his men eating the priestly bread, and Jesus himself says that, right? Just so we're clear, just so the Matthew's audience is clear, he says that was only for the priests. It's priestly bread. And then he goes on to say this, or have you not read in the law of how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? So another alleged controversy there that Jesus is getting at. But what's most striking is what he says next, when he says, I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. Right? There can be no doubt then about Jesus's self-reference here to being greater than the temple. Now, I do talk for about 2 or 3 pages about this passage and how to interpret it on page 129 and following. Let me just kind of summarize here, since we're winding up this episode. The bread of the presence that's described is very, very significant here. The first problem we have to overcome, though, is that the term is often mistranslated. It's often translated as showbread, S-H-O-W. The Douay Rheims, unfortunately, I think, translates it shoebread or showbread with an E or an O. And these are, quite frankly, unfortunate translations, because they actually come from Martin Luther in his German translation of the Gospel of Matthew, where he translated it very poorly from a Schauenbrot from the German, when the actual Hebrew of the term is lachem panim. And lachem panim quite literally means bread of the presence. Lahem is bread, like in Bethlehem. Panim means face or presence. So it's actually bread of the face or bread of the presence, which is pretty striking that Jesus is talking about this priestly bread that David eats and his men eat, his disciples, so to speak, that is priestly bread and is in the holy place and is the bread of the face. And this is Jesus's main argument in terms of making this defense. I marshal much more evidence as to what Jesus is getting at here. And clearly Jesus is sort of telling the Old Testament story, but to insert himself and his disciples into the place of David, who is this priestly figure, and his disciples into the place of those who legitimately eat the priestly bread. So it's not only a statement of Jesus's connection to David and David's kingship and David's priesthood after the order of Melchizedek, but it's also a remarkable statement about Jesus's apostles as priestly figures who are eating this priestly bread. And much more to say here, of course, in terms of the connection between the Eucharist and the bread of the presence. But one of the things that just slays me, it's amazing, is what Brant Petrie says about this bread of the presence that he finds from the Jewish tradition. I'll have to tease you because there's not time here to talk about it, but you can read it on page 131, and it's absolutely amazing. Unfortunately, though, that's all the time we have for today. We will see you next time as we move into Chapter 8 on the Solomon's Porch podcast. God bless.
You've been listening to Solomon's Porch, the weekly podcast offered by best-selling author and biblical scholar Dr. Stephen C. Smith. For more information or to join a growing community of people seeking to understand God's temple presence in their lives, please visit The Outer Court at facebook.com/The Outer Court. While there, you can also sign up for the free House of the Lord book discussion group. Solomon's Porch and The Outer Court are copyrighted and may not be reproduced without express permission. See you next time at Solomon's Porch.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land gift shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
I learned how many people we could help and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
These kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families. Children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of the people they are helping. You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit crsricebowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and to pray for those who are less fortunate.
The Cincinnati Catholic Men's Conference is back. Tickets are on sale now for Saturday, April 28th at the Taft Theater at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. The speaker conference roster is being hailed as one of the best lineups in the country. In rare appearances, come see Father Mitch Pacwa from EWTN, the man motivator Father Larry Richards, former Moeller High School and University of Notre Dame head football coach Jerry Faust, and the big celebrity keynote, Baz Rutten, UFC world champion, MMA world champ, and movie star. The conference theme is What It Means to Be a True Christian Man in Today's Society. Don't miss the incredible day of motivation, spiritual benefit, and fellowship with men from all walks of life. Get tickets now at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. That's cincinnatimensconference.com or 513-214-1534. Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.